Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. wandaspicks.asmnetwork.org. Tune in Wednesday 6 to 7 a.m. and Fridays 8 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time. This is a Black arts and culture site. We will be exploring the African diaspora via the writing, performance, both musical and theatrical, film and stage, as well as the visual arts of Africans in the diaspora and those influenced by these aesthetic forms of expression. I'm interested in the political and social ramifications of art on society, specifically movements supported by these artists and their forebears. It is my claim that the artists are the true revolutionaries, their work honest and filled with raw, unedited passion. They are true heroes. Ashe. So remember, visit us on Wednesdays 6 to 7 a.m. and Fridays 8 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time on wandaspicks.asmnnetwork.org. Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks. We have an exciting show planned. We're joined in the studio by two women to talk about Dr. Evans, what's the name of the program that's going to be happening tomorrow in Sacramento?
Yes, Ross Dance Company is presenting the second annual Sacramento Praise Dance Festival.
Right, yeah, and I know there are a lot of people like me that didn't know about the first one. So I'm really happy that you were able to join us on such short notice, you and Ms. Jones Bay, to talk about this exciting program. Let me tell you, tell our audience a little bit about both of you, and then you can tell us about, you know, the praise dance genre of movement and your company, as well as this extravaganza, which is going to be hosting many, many companies. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I don't know how to pronounce your first name, Dr. Evans. How do you say it again?
Tisha.
Dr. Tisha Evans is the co-founder, co-owner, and she founded Ross Dance Company in 2005. So you're about 7 years old?
Yes, we are.
Yeah, wow, awesome. How large is your company?
The professional company, we have a total of 3 professional dancers, and we rehearse weekly, and the repertoire that we put on is what you'll see at the festival. And then we have our committee staff, which is made up of 5 individuals, and then we have several volunteers that help out every year with our events. So it's definitely probably a group of 10 to 12 people.
Okay, yeah. And you received your bachelor's of arts in psychology and dance from UC Berkeley, and they've got a really fine program.
Yes.
And you received your doctorate in clinical psychology from California School of Professional Psychology. Whoa, what a combination.
It is indeed.
And you're also a dancer. You've danced for over 15 years in jazz, modern hip-hop, and praise dance. Okay, cool. And you chair the committee for the local praise dance conference and festivals, which you created. Your choreography has appeared in Oakland, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and a variety of churches in California. And, didn't know this was on. And your mission is to use dance as a way to spread the gospel and exalt Christ with excellence.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're also joined by Mrs. Tiana Jones Bay, and she's been with your company for 4 years, and you're the director of the Children's Conference. What mm-hmm. is the Children's Conference?
So we have, in addition to the adults that we serve every year, we have a smaller conference for the children ages 7 to 11, where they get to come and learn some dance technique, and we talk about, you know, Bible scriptures that would pertain to praise dancing, and kind of just talk about a little bit about what it means to be a praise dancer for them in their lives and how they can apply it. And then we teach them choreography, And this year they had the conference that we had in Oakland, the participants had an opportunity to minister in the Oakland Festival from the choreography that they learned the day before. So it was really exciting, and we always get a great bunch of kids that are just, you know, so inspiring how on fire they are for the Lord at such a young age, and to see the talents being developed so early.
So the parallel conference, was that also happening in Sacramento? Could you mention
that? Not this year.
Okay.
Go ahead, Jesus.
Oh, yeah. We don't have a conference in Sacramento. We have our children adult conference in Oakland, and then adult conference and teenage conference in L.A., where all the dancers are grouped together.
Oh, okay. So this is just a concert Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay. Okay, you can just watch and just enjoy. Mm-hmm. I want to take classes.
Yeah, well, we offer monthly classes, so you are definitely welcome.
Oh, nice, super. Mrs. Jones Bay, you received your BA in theater from the University of Southern California.
Yep.
And while at USC, you co-founded a praise dance group, Anointed Vessels of Praise. Huh. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a really nice name. Well, that's interesting. You and Dr. Evans, you've been dancing over 15 years, and she's got 15 years, over 15 years in hers, too. Did you all start dancing at the same time?
We didn't know each other at the time, but I'm sure, you know, our walks have been parallel in some respects.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. really cool. Yeah, and your background is in jazz and praise dance. And you co-lead the praise dance ministry, which you mentioned, that you had the children's conference. And you're at the Covenant Worship Center in Berkeley, California. Mm-hmm. And you co-coordinate the local praise dance conference and festivals, which we're speaking about now. And you have a passion for working with the youth and using praise dance to foster their development and spiritual relationship. So why don't we start with you, Mrs. Tiana Jones-Bay, why don't you talk about this last part of your bio, this passion you have for working with the youth and using praise dance to foster their development and spiritual relationship. Why don't you maybe tell us how do you define praise dance, and then we'll shift over to Dr. Evans to add to that definition. And then about the youth, what you mentioned about how they were just so excited at the last conference, the one that was in Oakland at Laney College, and you mentioned how they had some choreography that they were later able to share and use as a part of their ministry. So how does that work?
So first, I think you asked how we define praise dance. For me, praise dance is just using dance to minister to others and to share the gospel of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. So it can be, you know, any genre really that you want to use, as long as the purpose behind it and the message is clear that it is to share the gospel with others. I mean, you can use, you know, I've seen hip hop, you know, traditionally it's more like lyrical and jazz. There's mime, you know, you can do African, just kind of whatever movement that God inspires in you to relay a message of Jesus Christ and to minister to others, for me, is praise dance. And it goes back to, you know, in the Bible, in biblical times, David, I think, was definitely a praise dancer. Miriam in the Old Testament also was, like, the first, like, woman prophetic praise dancer. So it's definitely biblically based, and more churches are embracing, you know, praise dance as a part of their worship, so it's very exciting. And I think the other part of your question was about the children. I definitely, you know, children are just so open and so spirited, and, you know, they also have talents, you know, in the dance, and it's so great to be able to kind of mold and shape and show them, you know, so often what kids see, you know, is on the TV, and this is what they aspire to do and what they think. It's just all about, you know, seeing the Beyoncés and Lil Waynes and whoever, but just show them, like, no, you can use your talents and you can dance and uplift Christ at the same time. And when they are able to see that, just to see, like, a little light turn on in them, and to be able to kind of mold and shape and guide that and really strengthen and build their talents so that they will continue to kind of plant seeds and start with the foundation so they can build upon it and grow. And, you know, it just helps them be, I think, more well-rounded individuals as a whole, as well as strong praise dancers.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Evans, why don't you add to that definition, and then I have a question. It sounds as if praise dance is, because you mentioned that the style sort of crosses different types of dance, and it sounds like it's the intention behind the movement that makes it praise versus just out for a good time.
Yes, I thought Tiana did an excellent job answering that. I completely agree with her as far as the purpose of praise dance. Like she said, you can use different styles, but it's really the purpose and the intention and the quality behind it. It's not just, you know, regular dance, but it's a type of worship and a type of praise and a type of celebration. So it's definitely more powerful because you're sharing your love for Christ through dance. So just to see the kids and to see adults and older adults use this type of art to praise God is really a wonderful sight to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking as you were talking that other spiritual traditions also have praise dance, and they might not necessarily be praising the Creator under or by the names that others might know. I think about some of the Orisha traditions. I think actually not some of them, but all of them. And there's a sacred aspect to the movement, you know, that involves songs as well as dance.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could talk about this whole tradition of praise dance, and as a company founder and presenter, sort of what's the thinking around your choreography?
Yes, as far as my choreography goes, it first starts with praying and really asking and seeking God, what is it, what message do you want us to achieve and to really deliver to the community? And this season, we had our particular piece called The Greatest Gift, and God just really answered my prayers about every part of the piece, and it was just amazing to have the Holy Spirit speak to me in that way about who's doing which role, what type of music to do, what type of lighting to do, and what type of movement, which stems from contemporary jazz. That's the vocabulary that's being used, and also even what type of video to incorporate. As Ross, God really uses us to, you know, challenge our movement and to push praise dance even further. And so we incorporate video and theatrics as well as dance in our piece. And so the first part really starts with praying and seeking God and what His purpose is for each piece that we create. And Ross just really stems from that. Each year we have a very clear purpose and instruction from God, and the dancers that I work with, including Tiana, Lauren, Eric, they do an amazing job making that vision come to life in that ministry. So Ross, we really appreciate doing the professional part, but as well as the ministry part, which is working with a lot of different churches and ministers as far as praise dance ministers, and having classes and conferences to really strengthen their skills as praise dancers. Sometimes with praise dance, dancers aren't always able to be professionally trained or take ongoing classes. And so part of our mission and part of our role as praise dance is to really equip a lot of these praise dance ministers in their ministry so that they can really, really spread the gospel and do it with excellence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. So talk about this big concert tomorrow in Sacramento, and let our audience know where it's happening and who has been invited, and how the annual concert which is the second annual tomorrow, expands on the vision that was started last year of the concert that had its debut last year.
Yes, so the second annual Sacramental Praise Dance Festival will be tomorrow at Veterans Memorial Theater in Davis, and the event starts at 7 p.m., doors open at 6:30, and the community can purchase their tickets online by going to rossdance.com, or they can give our office a call. And we're really excited about the program. We have a total of 9 acts. We have Valley Bible Church, PFBC, Victory and Praise all the way from Modesto. We have First Baptist coming from Pittsburgh. We have Kira, who's coming from Los Banos. We have Ross Dance, who's going to be also dancing. We have Center of Praise. And, Tiana, am I missing anyone else?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah, and then also we have On One Accord from Elk Grove and With Grace from Elk Grove. So it's a full group, and these groups are coming from all over the area just to praise God. And the event, this will be our second year doing Sacramento. We did one in Oakland 2 weeks ago at Laney College, which sold out, and it was just a great celebration of worshiping Christ. And then in a couple weeks, we go to L.A., and we'll be having our Praise Dance Conference there July 28th, as well as our Praise Dance Festival on July 29th in Linwood. And if anyone wants more details, they can definitely give us a call or visit our website at rossdance.com.
Mm-hmm. Tiana, were you talk about? Are you both going to be dancing?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So talk about you know, being both, you know, in front of the camera and off camera. I mean, your choreographing and your, you know, your teaching and then your dancing. So to talk about sort of wearing these various hats and what you're looking forward to most in this particular installation of the conference, the festival, and do you have any work premiering in this particular festival?
I don't. All the choreography that Ross is doing this time is from Tisha. But, yeah, you talk about wearing multiple hats. It's definitely a labor of love. I mean, it is a commitment that I'm passionate about, you know, in both. You know, I think Ross Dance does a great job of, like, coupling my passion for, one, praise dancing and ministering in that respect, and also, like, encouraging and supporting others and working with kids. So it's just kind of, like, all-encompassing for me. So, yes, I mean, although we have intense rehearsals, like Tisha is not playing when it's time to get the stuff done. And then, you know, on the flip side, organizing everything and making sure that the conferences are worthwhile for the people to come out, and that it's, you know, quality and fun. It's a labor of love. It's something that I feel passionate about, that I feel called to do. So it's, you know, it's wonderful, and it's wonderful to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So talk some more about the praise dance. I hear you calling, you're saying, you know, it seems like it's coming from the Christian tradition. And an earlier question was looking at praise dance as being a part of other traditions. I was wondering if you could speak to that, Dr. Evans.
Praise dance being a part of other
traditions as well that are not Christian-based.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. As far as what other communities or what other religions, how they incorporate praise dance, I'm not too familiar with that. I know that, you know, the Jewish community also takes pride as well as using dance to worship. And I know that other cultures use that to praise their own gods. As far as details on that, I'm not very familiar. I usually just keep my focus on, you know, with the Christianity and just really using the biblical references as far as David, Mary, and other figures in the Bible and how they use praise dance and how the Holy Spirit wants us to use praise dance really as a framework for what we do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So sorry, not able to answer that too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tiana, do you have any comments? Because you mentioned the different types of dance genres and
mm-hmm.
how it's not the form, it's the intention.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering,
mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with some of the Pan-African spiritual traditions and how
mm-hmm.
They use dance to praise the Creator?
Mm-hmm. So I, before Dancing with Ross, I danced for, I think, 2 seasons with Afro-Brazilian company.
Oh, yeah.
And
which one?
And so I am familiar, Aguas de Bahias,
yeah.
with Tanya Santiago.
Oh, mm-hmm. She's great. She's getting ready to do something in August. I mean, they're having rehearsals now, I noticed, at Dance Mission. Oh,
yeah, so I was able. I am familiar a little bit with what you're talking about with the Orishas, and it is like, you know, specific movements come represent their different deities, and it all has purpose. So I think it can be similar. I think like the difference with praise dance for us in Christian faith is, you know, that it's about Jesus and representing, ministering the gospel of Jesus Christ through your dance moves. So you can use, you know, I find myself, Atisha likes to use a lot of African movement also. You can use African movement, you can use hip-hop, you can, you know, use jazz and ballet. So praise dance can encompass a variety of types of movement, but like you said, the intention and the purpose is to give the people Jesus Christ. I think that's where the difference lies. Because certainly every culture has their own form of dance, which is great, and I try to like learn about all the different forms of dance and how it's used in different cultures, because God is not in a box. Like you can use
mm-hmm.
you can use, you know, anything for his good work, and he's given us creativity and he's given us these other things, and so why not use it to, you know, uplift him.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I certainly see how praise dance, and particularly the work that you, Ross Dance Company, is doing around these conferences and these festivals, which is really awesome, as a way to sort of bring community together.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Talk a bit about the music that you use to illustrate or to accompany these visions that you ask. It sounds like they're divinely inspired visions.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Evans, talk about mm-hmm. the music and some of the artists that you find yourself. I don't know, this particular piece that you choreographed for this festival, and I believe you said it's in the jazz genre of dance. Is it an artist that you like and that you're some of the piece, or do you have multiple artists that you're using for this to dance to for this particular piece? And does it have a name? And if you already told us, I forgot. So tell me.
No problem. Yeah, so the piece is called The Greatest Gift,
right.
And it's actually a combination of 4 different artists. And so the first piece is, I want to believe, by Kirk Franklin. And then the second piece is done to a culmination of drumming, which I really, really love, because a lot of times you'll see praise dance done to gospel music, but I feel, just like what Tiana said, God gave us all these different things to use, such as music and style, so why not tap into them all? And so the second piece, it uses drumming to really bring the peace alive. And then the third piece is I Need You Now by Smokey Norful. And it's a wonderful part of the entire piece because it's really talking about being desperate for God and knowing that you cannot do this on your own and just having Him pour into you. And so it's a very soulful and very endearing piece done to I Need You Now. And then the fourth song ends with Kirshner, and it's You Are. I just love her as an artist. And it's upbeat, it's up-tempo, really getting the crowd involved. We have some African movement that's incorporated as well as some jazz movement. And so I typically use different artists. This year, I think, is probably one of the first times I actually incorporated drumming, which I think all of us were really excited about. So it really takes you through a variety of motions from being just really in the presence of God and just wanting that closeness and, you know, sometimes not knowing how to always get there, but knowing that you want to get there, but, you know, having that struggle and sometimes in our walk, and then really ending with this idea of, God, I know you're there, even though I might have some ups and downs, I know you've got my back, and I'm going to be okay, and I'm going to be strong through this walk with Christ. And so it's a really touching piece, and I'm really excited to have the dancers minister it on Saturday.
Wow, sounds really wonderful. Mm-hmm. Do you ever have live music?
Not yet, but I am praying on that. I want to have live. I think if I have live music, I'll probably want to have live drumming. We had live drumming at our conference for most of the day, and it just brings out a different quality of movement. And so one day we will have some live music.
Oh, that'll be really, really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you ever, in the praise dance, and I'm just thinking about the African spiritual tradition, of sort of being captured by the spirit, do you ever have is there ever a part of the conference, let's say, because I'm not sure if you could do that in the festival, where people can actually create right there? I think that would really be cool if you had live music. So that sounds like that might have been possible at the conference if you had drumming. So is that ever a part of any of the programs that you and Ross Dance hosts?
Yes, as far as the conference, it was. We had live drumming. Makita was able to grace us with her presence, and she also had a guest. So we had live drumming, and there was actually an exercise, the choreography workshop, which I lead, and the exercise was to first, you know, pray to God about what the whole purpose of your piece, because they're going to create a few eight counts in just 30 minutes. And they were working with different dancers from different ministries. And their whole goal was, how do you get connected to God's vision as far as what He wants you to deliver through your movement? And then how do you produce that effectively? And so they did a 30-minute exercise where they were working with six or seven people that they just first met that day, and they came up with the beat of what they wanted. They gave it to Makita. They were very clear about the vision God had given them, and they were able to minister in less than 30 minutes on the spot, creating a piece and working with people that they typically don't work with, but share the same goal and share the same vision. And that was amazing to see. Unfortunately, we are not able to do that at our concert, but at our conference, to be able to have that interactive learning and to really have them use the skills they learn on the spot was really awesome.
Mm-hmm. And they also had the portion, Tisha, where it was just like free worship, where they come out in the circle as the drums were going, and they were just kind of letting the spirit freely move. And I thought that was also powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, wonderful. In closing, I wanted to know if perhaps each of you could talk about, because Dr. Evans, your credentials are not necessarily what one might think about as the credentials for a person that's founder of a dance company and, puts on, a praise dance conference and a festival and interesting, all this clinical psych, and so we've got the dance and we've got the praise, and then we've got the the mental stuff happening there. It's like, that's interesting. I thought you could talk about sort of your journey. And then Mrs. Tiana Jones-Bev, since you could talk about the importance of dance in your life since it seems like you've been doing it for a while.
Yeah, so basically for me, I wear two hats, and God has been so gracious to give me the time and the resources to do it. You know, people ask me, well, how do you balance the two? And my answer is always the same, through God's grace and his mercy and for him just keeping his hand over my life. So during the day, I have another job. I'm a clinical psychologist at a hospital, and so that's a passion I have, with just working with people and just helping them each day be able to strengthen their own mental health. So it's in a way, it's like a ministry, because just assisting people to become more whole with their souls and with their mental health. And so that's one other hat that I wear that keeps me busy and keeps me on my toes. And then the second hat I wear is with Ross Dance, and working with my staff and with my company members, and doing a lot of community outreach. And even though they sound kind of separate, they're in a way, it's similar, because it's ministry work and working with people and pouring into people. And so sometimes I pull my psychology hat in with dance and with the type of things I'm able to do with dance and being expressive. Sometimes I pull that in with my clinical work and, you know, teaching people how to open up and be vulnerable. So I'm able to, interestingly, use both skills so that it can help people. So I thoroughly enjoy both passions.
Right. Yeah. And Tiana?
Yeah, so I believe the question was kind of how dance has played a role in my life, throughout my life.
Yeah.
So definitely dance has been a huge part of my life. I've always had a passion for it. I didn't start out in praise dance. I started out just with jazz and tap and hip-hop and, you know, as you know, went into Afro-Brazilian. And it's just always, I feel like there's always been a pull on my life to come back. Like, when I discovered praise dance in college when I first got saved and was kind of like, oh, wow, what is this? This is awesome. I can continue to dance and praise the Lord. And so that's when I co-founded Anointed Vessels of Praise at USC. And that was such a blessing. And just since then, this has always just been a pull on me. Even though, you know, life happens and trying to walk away, and God saying, nope, you're still called to do this. You're still called to do this. Like, I have two beautiful kids now and still, you know, married with two kids. And though that life can be, you know, also demanding and consuming and keep you full and busy, there's still this pull to minister and praise dance. And it's also therapeutic for me, for myself. Like, it helps me just feel more, I don't know, focused and connected to the Lord, and I kind of am able to, whatever's going on in life, come back to it, and it really, like I said, it's a blessing and helps me. So it's definitely a huge part.
Wow, yes, really great. So congratulations, you know, on your second annual Praise Dance Festival. And Dr. Evans, can you give us the details one more time?
Yes, no problem. It's going to be tomorrow, our Sacramento Praise Dance Festival at Veterans Memorial Theater. The event will start at 7 p.m. Tickets are available at rossdance.com, and that's rossdance.com. And we would love for everyone to come out and just praise and worship God with us.
All right, super. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and have fun at the festival. I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it, but definitely want to get connected. Well, I think I am connected now to your circuit, so if you can't make it to Sacramento, then maybe I can catch the third annual as well as the conference when you come back up to Northern California.
Great. Well, thanks, Wanda, so much for having us. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. And keep up the great, wonderful dance work.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Peace and blessings.
Bye-bye.
We are joined in the studio by one of my favorite activists, Mr. Jesse Brooks. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Wanda. I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. I am so excited. You know, it's like I was so excited. I thought you were the director of this new film.
Oh, I know.
Endgame for AIDS in the Black America. What a wonderful work. Oh, my God. Renata Simone has just, it's just such a fabulous sort of wide-ranging work that features
wow.
you as well as others, and it's going to be debuting on Frontline, on PBS Frontline on Tuesday, July 10th, and people can check the local listings, but one of the times is 10 o'clock, but I'm not sure if it's 10 o'clock. Is it 10 o'clock Pacific time?
Yes, it is.
Okay, right, because I know sometimes they can do it so that it's the same time throughout the country. And what's really great about Frontline is that afterwards you can watch it online, so that's even great. But you want to be tuning in with everybody else, so it's going to be really cool. So why don't you talk to us about Endgame, AIDS in Black America, because, you know, as an activist, that's one of the, I don't know, maybe one of the primary messages that you have been speaking to for as many years as I've known you,
right?
About ending it. I'm like, okay, you don't have to get infected. You don't have to die if you are infected. Yeah, talk about this wonderful work and your work and how the two sort of coalesce and come together in such a wonderful way here.
Thank you, Wanda. So evidently you did see, you viewed it and it affected you. Like it affected me. I think Renata did a wonderful job of weaving a story. And the story she told was HIV and AIDS affecting people that weren't in the media's attention in the early years, and which were Black people alongside white people. And the media attention was on white gay men. And over here, and so it tells the story of this happening right across the bridge in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
but then right across the bridge in Oakland, it was happening. And Renata breaks down the truth that the fourth patient that was discovered in L.A. was Black.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, I never heard that before.
Right.
I thought everyone who was infected in those early years, everyone who had died these horrific deaths because, you know, the medical profession didn't know how to treat it, I thought they were all gay white men.
Well, we all did.
I know.
Because of the images that the media portrayed. And also there was no mention of race.
Mm-hmm.
Which was not intentionally, but that's what happened. And so because of that initial face of HIV, us as Black people were thought that we weren't at risk. And it was easy for us to be in denial
mm-hmm.
about it happening here, as I saw so many people die of HIV and AIDS here in Oakland in those days, and we just didn't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I saw so many people die, and they called it everything else. People were more proud to say cancer than HIV because it's such a stigma. And so as a fact, we find ourselves in 1998, Alameda being the first city, Oakland, declaring a state of emergency in African-American communities.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I remember that. And we're still in a state of an emergency in 2012. And I'm like, oh,
that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's really horrific. Yeah, yeah. And in the film, you mentioned how your brother, and those are some great photographs that you share with the director.
Thank you.
Wow, they're so beautiful. You favor your brother as well. That your brother died from AIDS.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah, and how that really frightened you quite a bit.
Well, not just my brother, mm-hmm. you know, who was a man that had sex with men, a gay man, but so many of my friends that I, as a young gay man, danced alongside in the clubs of Oakland, I saw them die. Mm-hmm. Even when they had the first drug, AZT, they continued to die. So when I was diagnosed, in 1993, I just knew it was a death sentence. And it wasn't. Because a couple of years later, they came out with the regimen of the drug cocktails, which changed everything, where people started living with HIV and AIDS because of these drugs that, like in the film Magic, that's what he says. I'm not cured of HIV. I'm only healthy because I take my meds every day. So these meds came and turned everything around. But in my head and in the visuals I saw in Oakland was once you were HIV positive diagnosed, you were dead. And many people still think that. And it's not true.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It looked like the director was interviewing you in your home. How did she come? I mean, you're a real high-profile person. You got a column in the Oakland Post. You got all these different associations that you're a part of, local, you know, civic organization as well as national, international organization. Is that how she knew you? Because you're like so famous, or yeah? How did she come to interview you along with some of the other? You know, folks here in the San Francisco Bay Area, like Joe Hawkins and Bishop Yvette Flunder, and some of the other people that I recognized in the film. How did she? Because the film actually, this director, she is an expert in covering this particular topic and focusing on the Black community in particular. You know, in Endgame, is sort of a direction that her work was going in all the time. I mean, because of the series that she produced for PBS, a three-part series that she produced. Funny, could you tell us how she came to know you and have you in the film?
Well, I don't know really how she came to how it put together, but people told her about me and they kind of looked me up, but it wasn't hard, like you said, to find me because, you know, I'm on posters mm-hmm. with saying that I'm HIV positive. I'm on posters with my face. I'm on posters with my niece that's talking about how we as negative people, positive people, can fight HIV. And a lot of people still have that stigma, and so I do it to break down that fear and to show people the face of HIV. So those two connected, the face of HIV, and then I'm on posters, is how she came to find me. Mm-hmm. You're right, Renata has started her work way back in 1989, like she was one of the first to do a national series on HIV. I think it was AIDS Quarterly with Peter Jennings. And then she did this award-winning film, Age of AIDS, 25 years of HIV, really an extensive piece about the science. And so this, she wanted it to be different. And like I said, because of the lack of media attention on the African-American community, the denial, the stigma, that we find ourselves with high transmission rates in our community, and still no one's talking about it. And so we find ourselves that half of the infections each year, which nationally are like 56,000, are African-American, women, men, youth. And so we are the face of HIV. So that's what the film is about. Mm-hmm. But it's also the end game. We have came so far after 30 years. Not knowing what this disease is, to finally knowing the science of it, how how to stop it with the new drugs. Like I said, in 1998, they realized that they needed like three drugs to stop the disease in three different ways, because the drug is that smart, and that changed everything. But even after that, there's so much technology and knowledge that we know now that we feel, and I feel, that we have all the tools that we need to eradicate HIV.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
We just have to use them and get people tested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly, certainly. When I was, the film is, it's really, the director has a wide spectrum of people that are infected and how they become infected. And I think one of the moving stories, two of them actually, was the story of the woman who meets her husband at church.
Yeah.
And he is infected, but he doesn't tell her. And they have all of these wonderful marriage counseling sessions with the pastor, and he never discloses at
right.
all, and then she gets sick, and she just sort of stumbles upon the information, and I think, wow, that is so amazing. And she's an older woman; she's got grown kids, she's got
right.
grandchildren,
right.
So it's like, oh, it doesn't just
she
happen
loves
to young
God,
people.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, and then the pastor, he thinks, you know, this woman met this man in my church, like, uh-oh, you know, like, what do I do with that, and how do I handle that, because this is a member of the church, and he needs to be ministered to, and then I have to, like, how do I bracket, my anger with him for what he did to another member of the congregation, whom I love equally. So that was like, wow, what a story. And then the other story that sort of brought up Michelle Alexander.
Well, I want to speak to that, to Nail's
okay.
story, is who
okay.
you're talking about. Her name is Nail.
Nail, okay.
And I wish Renata was on here with us, because what Renata talks about when you talk about that story is that Nail's story is not unique. She hears it in southern cities. She hears it in cities in the east. So everywhere that... in the black community, there's a story like Nail of an older woman, like my mama, who maybe have lost her husband. And in the past, you know, you would look in the church for a partner. And so she found this deacon in the church. And like you said, to her horror, discovered that she not only was HIV positive, but that he hadn't known about it and not told her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so a lot of it is the pink elephants in our community that contribute to this disease. We don't want to talk about sex, even though we have babies everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to, and anybody that has sex, and that's older woman, needs to know that you're at risk for HIV. It only takes you having sex with an HIV-positive person one time. And today, because of the advances in medicines, you can't tell a person is HIV-positive by looking at them. And, you know, and again, you don't have to become HIV-positive if you just heed the warning that anybody that has sex, it doesn't have to be a prostitute, a drug user. Nail tells the story, it could be a older woman, God-fearing woman that goes to church
mm-hmm.
and believes in God.
Right.
But just brought up in the old school way to just trust. And trust is killing us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking about how, I don't know if you still have to, but at one point when you were going to get married, you had to get a blood test. But I don't know, I guess you don't have to do that anymore, because if you had to get a checkup and a blood test before you got the license, then you would know about the health status of the partner, the person that you're going to be marrying. And then I was also, when you mentioned Nell, when I mentioned Nell's story, then you gave us some more background on it, the Black Coalition on AIDS in San Francisco, they have a program of a sort of a support group for women, older women,
right,
who have been infected. You know, these women are all like in their 40s and 50s,
right,
and they became infected because a lot of them, because they're past their childbearing years, don't think about contraceptives. Well, not contraceptives. Don't think about barriers because they can't get pregnant, and so they're not using protection, and then they're meeting men. A lot of black men are incarcerated, and that's another great story that this film tells about what's going on with HIV and AIDS behind the prison walls, and that one prison, Fulton. Oh my goodness.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm like, and one of the, you know, the doctor that's interviewed in, one of the patients talks about how no one had cared about his health status prior to meeting this doctor, and he's an African American doctor, and he's, you know, talking about how he's gonna, you know, prescribe this medicine so that the man's T cell count could be built up from, you know, actually doubled from where it is to where it could be. And then, you know, these men get out of prison and they come back in the community and they meet these great women, and sometimes they don't disclose and these women become infected. And that's the support group that Black Coalition on AIDS, that's what they're addressing, these infected older women that never thought that they would be the part of this growing face of HIV and AIDS in our community.
Well, you brought up some really good points for women especially. I mean, because the disease is so different for women. It affects women in so many different ways. And actually affecting a woman, it affects so many other people because women are caretakers. Mm-hmm. So HIV uniquely affects women so much harsher, affecting the whole family. And interrupting the whole family. But you talked about having a blood test at marriage, you know. And so I don't know either if they still do blood tests. But what I know now is that anybody that wants to have a partner, engages in sex, should get a blood test, should get an HIV test together. Mm-hmm. That should just be common. I don't care how old you are. And so that's the thing we have to change. Like, it cannot be the old school way of this mating game. You can't just meet people now and go have sex and get married without the precaution that really needs to happen. And actually, you know, someone said that they wish that was more in the movie, that how do you stay HIV negative?
Mm-hmm.
Should have been discussed more in the movie, because there is so clear ways to stay negative today.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and who knows, you know, the director has produced lots of films, and that might be the next one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, I want people to get the message that you do not have to become positive.
No, not at all, not
you
at all.
Not. And you do not have to stop having sex. You do not have to stop living. Mm-hmm. But you do have to change the way that you have been doing it in the past.
Yeah, and, you know, and Jesse, maybe that's the film you need to make.
You're right. I'm up for the challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was thinking also, as you mentioned, how you know HIV and AIDS diagnosis is not a death sentence. I thought about the young people that are singing and rapping in the film. These two boys, young men, who their mothers died because their mothers
right.
were infected with the disease, and they were born infected.
Right.
And they have, as a part of their healing process, have forgiven their mothers. I'm like, wow, this is just so beautiful. And then they talk about, you know, relationships. And I just love the young man whose grandmother raised him,
uh-huh.
and how it's such a loving family. And just to get it out in the open around the stigma that's attached to this diagnosis and to this disease that affects one's life. You know, she just would just say right off the bat, you know, we eat with my child, and if you have any problem with that, then you need to just,
right.
you know, you just go on, because we're going to all be eating together. We're going to all be doing blah, blah, blah together. And he grew up with such a great sense of who he is and that he wasn't his disease. I think that's such a beautiful story, don't you?
I actually, the young people that deal with this disease are my hero.
Mm.
You know, for me, you know, it is a challenge, but it's so much easier for me at my age to proclaim that I'm HIV positive than a young person to proclaim they're HIV positive and all the peer pressure and the ignorance at that age that sustains. So I really look at them as my heroes to put themselves out there to empower themselves. I feel that young man is blessed. Because not everybody's family has that reaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's horror stories of people being thrown out their house, and I'm talking about youth, and because the family found out they were HIV positive. There's horror stories of separate eating utensils and just treating people and isolating them. And, you know, what I know, too, is from the years that isolation and that kind of treatment has killed people. Not HIV, mm-hmm. but just being isolated by your family
right.
and the people you love, and as we talk about the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this young man, his grandmother, you know, she, because what happened is there were like four children, I believe, in the family when the mother died.
Right.
And they were going to put them all in separate foster care, and the grandmother said, "No, I'll just take them." And so she raised her grandchild
right.
from an infant. I totally agree and know that that this is not a story that it's all, you know, that this particular story is not one that we see often enough.
No, we don't.
Yeah, but it's you know, I'm so happy that it's there, you know, in the film so that people can see that this could be the story.
And just the self-esteem that young man had, and I say because of it.
Yeah.
And you know, and even before a youth gets positive, we're talking about self-esteem that
mm-hmm.
really creates the decision-making process. So if you really feel good about yourself, no matter what happens in your life,
mm-hmm.
you can succeed.
Right. Yeah. And you talk about that yourself, you know, going to church and then getting one of those homophobic sermons and then having to leave, and then you get home and nobody talks about it. And
exactly.
Yeah, and then Joe Hawkins talks about how his roommate took him to church, and then as soon as he walks in, the sermon was directed at him.
Wow.
And the man puts his hand on Joe's head and tries to exorcise the demon or the devil, gay something out of him.
Right.
And he's like, what? I mean, I was like, I can't even imagine such an experience.
Really? I talk to people, and we talk about God, and sometimes
mm-hmm.
that the conversation turns that way.
Mm.
You know, so we're
yeah.
talking about people, I don't know, still they're not getting it.
Yeah.
They're not getting it, and still trying to push religion into other, I don't know. They're just not getting in. And that was horrific what Joe encountered. You're right. I never had it that severe, but wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, talk about your family. We were talking about self-esteem, and you talk about, I mean, you were a model. You were born in Los Angeles, but you claim Oakland as your hometown, living here most of your life. You had a love for writing at an early age, and in 1970, while in sixth grade, your work was read on the Phil Donahue Show. You were the school president of your class. You're a graduate of Oakland Technical High School, Oakland Tech, as we know. You were a member of the National Guard in Fort Dix, New Jersey, from 1981 to 1983. And throughout all of your accomplishments, you write, you struggle with many internal battles, including drug addiction and acceptance of your sexuality. And now after overcoming a drug addiction, coming to terms with your sexuality and accepting that you're HIV positive, you now use your voice to educate Oakland's urban communities. And so you've got these various campaigns, 2006, HIV Stops With Us, I Choose to Disclose campaign, 2011, billboards in Los Angeles simultaneously in San Francisco and Oakland. You are on posters on buses, on Bay Area Rapid Transit or BART. You have this column in the Oakland Post, Black Paper. You have a 30-minute docudrama, The Ceremony, which played at the 2006 Black Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender Film Festival. You are among an acting troupe going inside Santa Rita Jail to do unprecedented HIV/AIDS education in May 2010.
That was so cool.
Cornerstone Theater Group of Los Angeles performed short plays focusing on HIV and AIDS. And then you're on a lot of boards, Policy Education Review Committee, Alameda Planning Council, Bay Area Regional African American HIV/AIDS State of Emergency Coalition, UC San Francisco Center for AIDS Prevention Studies Advisory Board, Alameda AIDS Research Coalition Advisory Board, and so much more. And you're getting ready to go to Washington, D.C. for
yes.
an international AIDS conference. And then you gave me a copy of this lovely book, That Could Be Me, The Untold Story of HIV in Oakland. Yeah, so I just gave a whole lot about you. And coming back to the self-esteem and
wow,
your family.
Well, it took a lot to get to where I am today. And,
uh-huh.
you know, and I don't mind telling my struggle. And it was an internal battle is what I finally realized. That all my life, like I said, I grew up in a family with my father, my mother, and I always knew I was gay, but I had a fear of talking about it. In the movie, in the end game, I talk about how my favorite uncle that I love, we were driving down the street, and I remember, and so I knowing I'm having these feelings for men, but don't know who to talk to, and he goes, you see that person right there? And it was an obviously gay man, and he says, I hate them. And he said it with such venom, feeling and emotions that I was so crushed and hurt. So, of course, you don't come out and say I'm gay, you know, for me. But that's who I was. And so it took drug addiction. I lost my first partner to a homicide, and that's when I went into drug addiction. But part of it was just dealing with internally who I am and being proud of who I am. And it took me almost dying, Wanda, with the drugs, to really want to live and want to give my life to God. And it made me not care about what anybody thought, and that's when I finally realized it really was never about what people thought. It was about what I thought of what a gay man is. Hmm. And what a gay man is to me is me, a man of character, who is honest, hardworking, dependable. Walks up in his community with his head held high. And is an example for young people. That's what a gay man is.
Yeah.
So it's not I had to turn it from a negative definition of what the world said it was to what I knew it to be, who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, you know, I empowered myself. So, and the more that I respect myself and am proud of myself, that comes off, and you get that respect and from other people.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't mind telling my story because we all go through self-identity in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And we just all have to come to that point of self-empowerment to know that we are wonderfully made in God's image and we can do wonderful things. And other people will stop your dream, your hopes, if you allow them.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it comes back to what do you think who you are?
Right.
And it comes from my foundation. You know, my mother, although we had differences in beliefs, she had unconditional love for me through it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my family, even now, we're learning to talk about those pink elephants
mm-hmm.
that we wouldn't talk about through the years because of me. pointing to those elephants. We need to talk about them to heal.
Yeah. What about your brother? You know, you have a brother who is also a man who loves men. You know, your deceased brother. So seemed like that might have been a point of reference and also maybe a comfort because he understood if no one else did.
Again, it was so much internal homophobia, we didn't even recognize the reality of who we were to be able to celebrate that together.
Oh.
So we just kind of hid and didn't talk about it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Wow.
Huh. Wow, yeah.
So that deep kind of homophobia, even we knew each other was gay, but we just didn't talk about it.
Oh, yeah, because you really looked up to your big brother.
I did.
Oh, wow, that's really deep.
It's in our families, it's in our community. I love to quote another activist in the community that, you know, black gay men are our community's dirty little secrets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to start talking and accepting our babies. Because, you know, I hear a lot of people talk about young people, but I think they want to exclude gay young people. And we have to, those are our babies too. Gay or whatever sexuality a person desires, they're still our brothers and our sisters and our babies.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I was thinking about Gary Harmon, wonderful activist who is no longer with us, whom I called a friend and mentor. And he talked about within our community, in the early years, Alameda County didn't have any HIV AIDS services, and so people have to go to San Francisco for services, and the cultural competency of those providing services was really absent, and he, you know, really worked hard towards, you know, establishing an AIDS office, you know, here in Alameda County and getting services in Alameda County and also getting, you know, sort of developing services that were culturally competent for people of African descent and people of other ethnic groups that, you know, particularly around practical and emotional support and that's sort of where the program that I started, the AIDS Volunteer Clearinghouse, came into fruition because we looked at services for people that took into consideration their culture and how, as a person of, let's say, you know, African descent, how we would want to be assisted in, you know, living with this disease or surviving, you know, this disease if, you know, we had a person in our family that might have passed. And also with regards to preventing, you know, the transmission of this disease and keeping people from getting infected in the first place. So we've come a long way from that because it's been like, oh, man, 20, 25, 30 years now.
Yeah, totally.
So things have gotten a lot better. Another aspect of the film, and do you have a few more minutes?
I do, and I wanted to talk about the International AIDS Conference.
Oh, yeah,
whenever
please.
You get time.
Yeah, yeah, please. Before we go to that, I wanted to talk about this the paraphernalia law that I hadn't heard of that was you know talked about with these I think these were doctors in Atlanta, Georgia, and a place called The Bluff, and they were doing some serious needle exchange, and it's not legal there, but the woman who exchanged over 100 needles, I'm like, oh, my goodness, that's a lot of dirty needles.
Right.
And that is so great that she can get clean needles. And then they were also doing HIV, the rapid test right there on site. And then there was support, you know, for the person one way or the other. You know, if it was negative, there was support. And if it was positive, there was support with regards to the diagnosis. And I just thought that just sort of spoke so well to Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, her book, which looks at the war on black people. They call it the war on drugs, but it was really the war on black people. And I'm like, wow, that is such a in-depth segment of the film. It is just like, ah. So I want to just talk about that.
Yeah, Renata did a great job highlighting the need for legalizing needle exchange everywhere, and because it's been proven that it helps people from getting HIV and getting Hep C and passing it on. And it's such a, it's been a proven program and a good prevention method. But there is a entities that want to criminalize it, like you said.
Yeah, but no, I was also speaking of the whole thing around the war on drugs and how that precipitated the dirty needles, because they would have these things called shooting galleries where people would go off the street and they would share needles and they would do their drugs, you know, sort of in these I would put quotation marks around safer places where I guess they wouldn't get arrested as easily as if they were on the street shooting up. But this really precipitated the spread of diseases via these dirty needles. But that, you know, is just a part of this whole. And then she shows how, you know, black people, black men in particular, were just being marched into the prison system.
And so you're right. You're talking about in the beginning, and I love the way Renata actually puts that together and really connects that, because HIV and AIDS, the first discovery was in 1981. But again, like you said, that was the era of the crack addiction as well. So that helped spread. Unprotected sex, and like you said, sharing dirty needles. So back then, a lot of ignorance, and people and the scientists didn't know a lot. So sharing needles were one of the highest transmission routes. And like you said, because of the war on drugs and because of the reluctance to legalize needle and syringe, so many people got infected trying to hide out. Or even going in and out of prison.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And we're talking about tattooing is a high transmission rate in prison of HIV. So it's not all sex. We're talking about tattooing transmits HIV as well.
That's right, yeah, blood to blood.
Yeah.
And then that warden who said, well, it's a sexually transmitted disease. They don't have sex in prison, so you can't give condoms to inmates to mitigate the spread of the disease because, oh, they're not having sex. I'm like, what?
Right.
What?
That's
so crazy.
It's so crazy, and it's so such a lie, and we know it. And they know it.
Yeah. And the doctor says, you know, he's asked on camera, it's like, of course he's going to say no. He can't give. He's like, no. Because if he said he's giving inmates condoms, and, you know, whether he is or not, he wouldn't be working there anymore. And he was one of the good guys because at least he was treating, you know, the men who are infected with, you know, HIV or AIDS. You know, he was trying to do what he could in a really compromised medical system, because we know the medical system in the behind the prison walls is if it's not good, you know, when we're not behind prison walls, we know that is not.
Oh, it's like double, yeah.
Oh yeah, it's horrible behind prison walls. So when you find a good physician, you know, that's definitely rare.
Well, that's something that advocates, you know, have been fighting for years, even here locally with Santa Rita and jail, is to provide condoms because there is sex happening in jails and prisons.
Yeah.
San Francisco jail actually has a condom vending machine.
Oh, super. Excellent. Excellent.
And it's been proven that it works.
Mm-hmm.
Again.
That's great. So, so I guess in California, it's not, I guess people, medical facilities behind bars can give prisoners condoms?
No.
It's not against the law? No.
No, it's against the law.
It's against the law. But
they don't have sex in jail or in prison.
Oh, that's nationwide.
That's nationwide.
Oh my gosh! Oh my goodness! So, that there's a
but there have
vending
been
machine.
Demonstrated places again, like San Francisco and some other places I can't name that have proven that the putting condoms, giving inmates condoms, lowers the HIV transmission rate. So even with that proof, you know, these entities still refuse to do the right thing.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
Oh, that is amazing. Yeah. So talk about the International HIV-AIDS Conference that's coming up this month, and you're going to be flying to D.C. or flying to another place and taking a train to D.C., and there's going to be all this symbolism and all these different kinds of big events to bring attention to this national crisis. And it's one of the I think you said that President Obama lifted the travel laws that made it so that people with HIV and AIDS could not come into our country. So anyway, talk about the conference and why this is such a coup for America.
Well, like you said, this is the 19th International AIDS Conference, and the conference started back in 1989, I think, and in 1990 was the last time that the conference had the ability to happen here in the United States because of the ignorance and fear back then. They put a travel ban on people with HIV coming into the country, so it no longer could happen here. And so President Obama lifted the ban, and he lifted the ban last year, and which made it possible to happen here. So the International AIDS Conference is where scientists come. Scientists, advocates from all over the world will meet up in Washington, D.C. and have a conference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're going to be there,
So we're also doing the March on Washington, which is a Keep the Promise march and rally, bringing together thousands of AIDS advocates right in the heart of Washington, kind of simulating Martin Luther King's march. And we're asking for resources for treatment, care, and prevention, cost-effective interventions, progress achieved over the last 30 years of combating AIDS could be lost if we don't continue to fund these things. So thousands of advocates are going to march down Washington. I get a chance to cover this. Like you said, I'm being flown to actually Atlanta, Georgia, on the 20th, where I will meet advocates on the 21st. We'll catch a train from Atlanta, Georgia, me and advocates from that area into Washington, D.C., to hook up with other advocates that will be there. And again, it's going to be over, you know, thousands of advocates marching. Wycliffe John is going to be a part of it. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, civil rights leader, Ambassador Andrew Young, Reverend Al Sharpton, Travis Smiley, Cornel West. So I'm hoping to interview all of them and capture this. And so it's going to be great. It's going to be historical.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be really exciting. We're looking forward to reading reading about your coverage, and you're going to be filming, and yeah, this could be that story that you know, how does one live with this disease, and how does one avoid you know, being infected in the first place?
It's all about communication and talking and having open and honest conversation. That's where we have to get to. And So the more people talk about HIV, the more people will be educated and aware of it. That's where it starts. Getting tested is the biggest one individual thing someone can do in knowing their status. People that know their status are less likely to pass on HIV to someone else and more likely to be in treatment, which lowers their viral load, which lowers their ability to pass the disease.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, yeah. And so we've been talking about Endgame for AIDS in Black America, directed by Renata Simone, award-winning filmmaker. It's going to be aired on PBS at 10 p.m. on Tuesday, July 10th, and you don't want to miss it.
And check your local listings.
Yeah, check your local listings, and you should tell all your friends and colleagues about it. It is a phenomenal film. Oh, my goodness. It is just... It's just stunning, and our guest, Jesse Brooks, plays a real prominent role in telling this story.
I'm so honored, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you again so much, Jesse, for joining us. And I have this clip. I'm going to – I hope I taped the right one. I'm going to play it, and you can stay on for a minute if you want to talk about it afterwards.
Okay.
Let me play it now.
Thank you, Wanda.
Uh-oh, did I do the right one? Oops, I think that was the wrong clip.
Oh, no.
Oh, shoot, I had the other one, and I wasn't certain which one it was, and I did the wrong one.
Okay.
Yeah, so, oh, well, so that is not going to work, but I will put the link for the clip on the website, because it's really, really interesting, the statistics that are shared with the regards to the transmission. It's just uncanny. Like, really, that many Black people are becoming infected still?
Yeah.
You know, at this this World AIDS Day event that is profiled in this in the early scene of the film, and
with Phil Wilson.
Yeah. Do you know him?
I do. I've met Phil Wilson a couple of times now, and he'll be at the International AIDS Conference. He's actually one of the main speakers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Were you aware of those numbers? I mean, it was.
Oh, yeah.
I could hardly believe it. It's like,
I mean,
what?
The numbers are just mind-blowing, period. Like you said, 12.5 Black people make up 12.5% of the population here in the U.S., but each year we make up over half of 56,000 transmissions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's divided between Black men, Black women, Black youth. Black women are starting to become one of the highest communities of HIV transmissions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So everyone certainly needs to tune in to Endgame, and I want to thank you so much, Jesse, for joining us to talk about the film and your work, and looking forward to hearing from you after your historic march on Washington,
awesome.
2012, and coverage of the International AIDS Conference, the 19th, right?
Yes.
Yeah, 19th. And really happy that it's back here in this country. And the president you mentioned is going to be at the plenary, at the opening of the conference, right?
Well, they invited him. I don't think he's confirmed, as I'm reading news, of yet. So it'll be a big surprise and a big honor if he does open up the opening day.
Right, yeah. Well, we hope he'll be able to fit it into his schedule because it's important. And you know, when the president appears at something as significant as the International AIDS Conference, that sends a a real strong message to the American people and to the world community. So,
he's actually did a lot towards HIV since being in office, like lifting the ban, but he's also created the first HIV and AIDS strategy plan that the United States ever had.
Oh, tell us about that.
Well, it's 10-year strategy plan, and I'm not prepared to really talk about it, so I'll kind of summarize what I know about it. So there's three specific goals to reach by a certain year, and I think it's like 2015, is like to have half of the transmission rates in certain populations down. And actually, through his guidance and through the committees that he's created, we're actually achieving those numbers.
Oh, that's excellent. Oh, that's great. Yeah, but it still would be nice if he's able to make it.
Yeah.
To the conference. I mean, we know he can't be everywhere, particularly during an election year, but it'd be great if he shows up. Definitely looking forward to your film.
Thank you.
All right. Well, you take good care, and you have a great day.
You too, Wanda. Thank you.
You're welcome. Peace and blessings.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So we're going to play this piece from African Tapestry, Prayer for a Continent, and then we're going to shift into an interview with Rochelle Farrell, who is actually at Yoshi's in San Francisco this weekend. And, I've got a couple of tickets for a lucky guest who can send me a message at wandaspicks.com, or you can send me a message at the radio show, blogtalkradio.com/wandas-picks. Alrighty, so here is African Tapestry, Prayer for a Continent, and that's Babatunde Lee.
Barasuwayo!
that was Babatunde Lee from his latest CD, a double CD at that. This interview with Rochelle Farrell was definitely a journey, as her fans know, any experience with her is. And this interview was conducted last year when she was appearing at the Razz Room. It's really funny. The publicist at the Razz Room at that time is now the publicist for San Francisco Yoshi's, Yoshi's in San Francisco. So so Lisa Bautista is referenced, and it's really funny. And it's still current. Her CD is not out yet that she mentions on the air. And we sort of just start right in the middle of the conversation. I am telling Ms. Farrell how much I really love her work and how I have been trying to talk to her for many years. And so happy that, you know, we finally got a chance to have this long, long conversation, definitely. And she brings into the conversation one of her mentors. But we're not going to be able to get to that, I'm sure, because this, this particular interview goes for a bit. But she's opening at Yoshi's tonight in San Francisco. And there is a great conversation with Joe Sam, artist Joe Sam, and one of my favorite journalists. And I was just thinking if that's going to be happening at the that's going to be taking place in the Heritage Center. So it's sort of perfect, works out really perfectly, the conversation between Joe Sam and Belva Davis. Belva Davis is a journalist, and she has a book just came out, I believe last year, Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. And it's a really wonderful, wonderful read. And so they're going to be talking, and so that's right next door. So you could actually go to the talk and then hang out and go see Rochelle Farrell afterwards. So it just works out just perfectly. And then the Fillmore Jazz Festival also kicks off this weekend, and that's going to be really cool. Glenn Spearman, I believe, Quartet is going to be performing, among others, and it's a free event on Saturday and Sunday up and down Fillmore. All kinds of great music. So it's going to really be fabulous. So you should definitely check that out. So here's Rochelle Farrell. I'm going to play a little bit of that interview.
Way more than I think I even recognize sometimes.
Hmm.
Remember he said never, ever, ever give up? This is going World War II. I'm in history books.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, they were in the thick of it and in the throes of, you know, starvation and suffering and rationing and war and, you know, the threatening, you know, takeover of this regime that was, you know, against all humanity, basically, except
mm-hmm.
for the one that they deemed to be human. And they had to fight, you know, against that. And it didn't look, you know, it wasn't looking too good.
Mm-hmm.
And Winston Churchill, you know, I think he came on the radio or something and, you know, addressed the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he was the Prime Minister of England. And he said, never, ever, ever. And I might mess it up. I don't remember whether it was give up or give in. You can probably Google that to see, because it's a very famous quote.
But right. Mm-hmm.
With the Rochelle Farrell paraphrase.
Yes, no, but some things are worth waiting for, and I just said to myself, I can wait. I'm going to keep on asking, and Lisa at the Razz Room, she is such a wonderful woman, and she, whenever she can, she gives me access, because the person I spoke to before you called is, you know, Beverly Lee of the Shirelles, and I'm like, you know, that's like the first girl group, so to speak.
Yes.
And I've spoken to Nancy Wilson, numerous times. I mean, so it's like, okay, I don't get access, but then I get access. It's just, it's not consistent.
Not consistent, but maybe when you pull back on it and see, you know, get a broader aperture of who it is that you're gaining access to, maybe there's another story to be told there, you know what I mean? There's another picture.
Yes, definitely.
Because, you know, when you zoom out on something, it looks one way, and you zoom in on something, it looks a whole other way, altogether different.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly true. That's certainly true, yeah. So I want to tape this, okay?
Okay, sure.
All right.
And Lisa seems like to be a really wonderful person, and mm-hmm. very rarely do I, you know, get that sense for people like this through email because it's so one-dimensional.
Right.
With mm-hmm. her spirit, her energy, her beauty just kind of like, you know, her humanity seems to just jump off the screen at you. I can't wait to meet her.
Yeah, she's in person, she's just as great as her emails.
Wow.
And her phone conversations. She's a wonderful woman and a great publicist because, you know, sometimes it's about the business, but for her, it's more than the business. She really loves what she does. She really loves the music and loves the artists that they bring in. And from everything that I've ever read, you know, from artists that have been booked there, you know, since Lisa has had her tenure, it's always a good experience, and they always come back.
Excellent. And how long has she been there?
I think Lisa's been there, seems like maybe 2 years or so. She's kind of recent. Yeah, she hasn't been there a long, long time, yeah.
Okay, so she's still jazzed about the whole process, the whole idea. It's not old hat to her yet.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think, for Lisa, I don't think it's ever going to get old hat. I think, you know, when it becomes old hat, she's gone.
She's gone.
yeah. I mean, you don't want things to become old hat. You want them to be fresh and fun, just like you.
Yeah,
you know, keep on like those standards that you know, invigorate with your fresh perspectives on and all your music that you've created. And
that's right.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how many times you do that same old song, it's going to be a brand new situation because the moment is always brand new.
Right, yeah. And I don't know, you probably know when you come to town, there are these people that is like, you know, Rochelle Farrell, it's like Rochelle Farrell Church. You know, they come. Oh yeah, she's coming in. You know, it's not like, you know how you put up the tents, right? You know, when they have the big oh yeah, seriously, people buy your whole, like, if you're gonna be there for 3 days, they get the whole series. and they bring their they bring their literature and they bring their ointments.
And they're paraphernalia.
Oh, totally, yes. And I just wait for you to just lay hands on them, right?
Oh, I've never really heard it put that way, Wanda, so thank you.
Oh, well, you're not sitting next to them. You're on the stage. I'm sitting next to the folks in the congregation.
Next to the folks in the congregation.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because I know whole families. Like I remember one Sunday evening, or early show. There was a father, and he's a minister, and his daughter, and his wife, and their children. I mean, the whole. Yeah, it's like a family affair. The last time you came through, I think it was May Day. I came to see you at, I think it was a 9 o'clock show. They might have added a show because you had sold out your run.
Okay.
And I treated a friend of mine who is a member of the, well, she actually works for California Coalition for Women Prisoners, and I'm on the board there. And I just felt, you know, it would be really wonderful for her, you know, to sort of like experience you because of the kind of work that she does and the kind of life experience she has had, because she's actually a formerly incarcerated woman herself, and she spent like many, many years in preside and had her children taken from her and adopted out, and it's been like a real ordeal, and she's just a wonderful woman, and she really enjoyed you. Yeah, she really did. Mm-hmm.
That's good. That makes me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, before we even get any further into the interview,
yes,
I am so interested in, this has been a dream of mine since I was a young woman. I used to go into the prisons with Grover Washington Jr. in Philadelphia.
Mm. Oh, wow, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
And he had the contact, and, you know, folks would just call me and I'd show up. So I knew nothing about it. I was so young at the time.
Mm-hmm.
All I knew was saying, you know, after they came off. But for years, I've been interested in, creating some type of, I don't know, nonprofit organization or some type of something mm-hmm. that would allow me access into the prisons. The men's prison too, but I'm focusing mainly on the women's prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because that evening I didn't get a chance to come backstage, you know,
uh-huh.
those guards again. But I actually brought a brochure for you, and I put a note on it about our organization, California Coalition for
really?
Women Prisoners. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I sent it back to you, but maybe I'm sure you didn't get it because we're having this conversation.
How about that?
Yeah, that was amazing. Yeah, and it's so interesting because next week, October 14th, is the 15th anniversary of a newsletter created and published and with the writings of women and by women who are incarcerated. It's called The Fire Inside, and Angela Davis is actually on this inaugural year, she gave the keynote, and on the 15th anniversary, she's given the keynote at the Women's Building in San Francisco.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, so definitely after we, you know, are not taping anymore, I'll get your mailing address and I'll send you information. I'll send you the information about the newsletter and put you on the mailing list and send you a link to the website for California Coalition for Women Prisoners, because the women would just love to have you come in. And you know, now because of what's going on in California, they're actually shutting down one of the women's prisons. It's called Valley State. And they're going to be shifting them around because they need to make more space for men. So, yeah, these two prisons in Central Valley, Chowchilla, almost face each other. There's one prison has a skilled nursing facility. What's the Central California Women's Facility, CCWF, and then the other one, Valley State. That's the one they're going to shut down, and we don't. And the women, they don't know where they're going. But yeah, that's instead of just releasing some of these women,
right.
And releasing some of the men too to make more.
Yeah, that's
not happening.
Yeah.
Just like we're going to just shift them and put them somewhere else.
No, because if they do that, then their whole economy, their whole micro economy, you know, will you know be shifted and shrink away.
Mm-hmm.
So they got to keep themselves in the job now. Come on.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
The system's got to keep the system in, you know, afloat first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, there's big money. Big money in the prison industrial complex.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's it.
Yeah. Oh wow. Oh. That's so interesting. Yeah, so definitely we can come back to that, and I'll give you the information because we definitely could facilitate that, our organization.
I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited now.
Oh, well, I am too because I want to be in the house when you go visit the women. That's going to be really cool. Yeah, because we also, you know, work with the young women because there's so many young people that are being sentenced to 25 years to life, you know, as children. You know, they hold them until they get to be 18, and then they send them to adult prisons. And there are so many children that are, like, so despondent and depressed around, good grief, you know, first offense, 25 years to life.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they might have been driving the car with a boyfriend who was, you know, involved in something the girl didn't know about, and she got charged as if she did it because she was driving the car.
But doesn't that go back to the harshness and the inhumanity of the pre-civil rights era?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, certainly. Certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Man, oh, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, you're out of Pennsylvania? No, not Pennsylvania. Is that correct? I'm trying to think. Where were you born?
I was born in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. And so you know Mumia's story, right? Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Mumia Abu-Jamal,
yeah. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, although I lost track because I've been, like, in a wind tunnel of my own.
Mm-hmm.
Did he pass? Did he make transition?
No, not at all. He's not that old. But he has, I think, almost exhausted all of his appeals. And so, because he's still on death row, and he keeps on, you know, his lawyers keep on, you know, trying one thing after another. But when Clinton got rid of that, he, you know, did that thing with the habeas corpus aspect of the appeal process, that really sort of limited what people could do. You know, that's how Troy Davis's legal counsel sort of hit a wall.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not up on that.
Well, you know, he was just executed.
Okay, I didn't
yeah.
know that.
Yeah, he was the young man who, I think he was convicted at 19. He was out of Georgia. And, yeah, and he spent, like, over 19 years incarcerated. Yeah.
Convicted at
19. And, yeah, first offense. And, yeah, and he was executed 2 weeks ago now. Yeah.
First offense.
Yeah.
Executed 2 weeks ago.
Right.
I'm just taking some notes here.
Yeah, you probably. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just saying you probably noticed on Facebook people went black for the weekend. He was executed, I think, let me see, September. Was it the 20? I think it might have been. I'm not sure if it was the 21st. It might have been the 27th or 28th. I'm not sure exactly. But then we went. It's sort of like a show of solidarity on Facebook. Everyone took their pictures and they went black for the whole weekend. So if you got Facebook friends or if you know and you saw the black space. Black picture, you know, where.
I ain't gonna front Wanda, I ain't even on Facebook, girl. Oh.
Okay.
I know I'm so behind. It ain't even funny. Layla put me on Twitter, and I went on there and I tweeted one time. And then when she was following me and saw that I had only tweeted one time in like about 6 to 9 months, she said, I'll do it for you. So she's been tweeting from my Twitter account for me. So I missed the whole thing. This is more proof and evidence that I need to get on Facebook and kind of re-assimilate just a bit into the world because I had to withdraw from the world. And that began around 2003. Because, you know, as an artist, one has to be completely wide open and vulnerable to everything, right?
Yes.
In order to take in all of this information, all this energy, digest it, synthesize it, and get it back out as music. You know what I mean? It's like emotional, spiritual alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
And as things started to speed up in terms of pace, technology, you know, technology sped up the pace of things. That life was already fast enough. As
right.
You remember how fast it moved when we had pages?
Oh, yeah.
You had a pager on your hip, and every time that thing went off, you had to go find a phone. But now they made it even faster because they put the phone in your hand. So now one is always available.
Right.
Well, you know, the expectation is to be always available for whatever. And that could be soup to nuts. And I had to, like, starting in 2002, between that and, you know, personal issues with family members who, you know, at this point it's the same. Back then, like 10 years ago, I felt like an anomaly and like I was, you know, odd man out and that I had some type of scarlet letter on me. But now it's de rigueur with artists and people who, you know, are find themselves coming into the public eye. I remember reading an article in Essence about the sister that won the Academy Award, who is from Baltimore and has her own late night talk show. I can't call her name right now. She played in the film Precious.
Oh yeah. Oh, you're talking about Monique.
Monique, yes.
Yeah. I heard. Does she still have her show? Because I heard they stopped some of her stuff. I'm like, wow. Oh, that's great. Yeah, I hear people say it's a really good show.
Yes. And she did a marvelous job in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know, I didn't hear anything about them stopping anything, but my point about what I brought her up is that she's a sister that I remember reading about maybe about 2004, 2005 in Essence magazine about how this. She was the first sister that I remember reading about that spoke openly about how the expectations of family and behavior of family changes when you begin to make a little money and you begin to, you know, come into public eye and, you know, perception about who you are begins to change. And I thought that was a really bold, brave, and courageous thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And this was back in 04, 05, maybe. Now in 2011, it's commonplace with Fantasia and many other artists who come out and, you know, do reality TV shows, and people can see for themselves now, you know, this dynamic, this personal dynamic of the artist being loved and adored and respected and, you know, advocated for in public, and then in personal and private lives, family members are at each other's throat, you know,
mm-hmm.
trying to claim what's theirs, a piece of the pie, you know, based upon some, you know, familial sense of entitlement, you know, or some genetic sense of entitlement.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
That coupled with, you know, the speeding up of the pace of life, it had meant that I had to do something very different, and that was I had to slow down
mm-hmm.
and withdraw, you know, myself from, you know, society, from life, from the thick of it, so to speak. Metaphor for it is I took my helmet off and got in the bleachers.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, that's nice. You sat out there with the congregation.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
I had to.
Mm-hmm.
It was all getting to be too much. And one thing I just really have an adverse reaction to, I just really have a pet peeve about, and that's being a statistic. And I know I'm a statistic in many different areas, but I don't need to know I'm being a statistic. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I got rid of, you know, rather than going the way of drugs and alcohol and, you know, self-anesthesia, and, you
mm-hmm.
know, whether it be through drugs, alcohol, sex, whatever, yada, 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 or even, you know, material things, I went through a situation where I ended up without a television. And so I never bothered to replace it for, like, 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I got my news from the Internet, and from other sources, you know. And that was when I began to make it a point of getting my news from overseas.
Because
mm-hmm. I just found, innocently and obliquely enough, I found that information came without a slant more often than not, you know. And I could just get the pure information. And, of course, you know, I was reading like a fiend back then, and I miss that now. But it was a way for me to put on the brakes. It was the only way I could think of could find to put on the brakes. You know what I mean? When you find yourself traveling too fast and there are no conventional brakes, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I had to, you know, think out of the box and come up with a creative solution, or at least, if not solution, a creative way to mitigate what was happening.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, I think you might call that sustainability, right?
Absolutely, yes, ma'am.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, you know, we think about sustaining the planet, and we've got to sustain our planet, which is our body,
that's
and
right.
our soul and our spirit and our mind.
That's right.
So, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It's great when one can step out of the turmoil and be still. And
yes.
And so that you can regroup and, you know, create more music. And you mentioned
mm-hmm.
when I saw you last that you were working on the album that you had just recorded. And you were talking about the sessions you had with those wonderful musicians that were on stage with you, and you would give us, you know, a song that you, you know, didn't have a name for yet.
Mm-hmm.
that's probably going to make it to the album. So how is that project coming along? Did you finish it?
I didn't finish it yet, but I'm very close. I'm about 80% done.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
And I'm very excited about it. I still don't have a name for it.
mm-hmm.
But I'm getting close. I'm tossing around a couple different song titles as names.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of living with that idea to see which, you know, which feels right. It's almost like I put myself in the, I guess, I don't know what the space is, whether it's the shoes or the mental, psycho, emotional consciousness or spirit of, you know, my contemporaries in the society and the world in which I live now, and, you know, those who would like my music and those who live with my music and try to feel what it is that they would want to call this project and how they would feel about the project. And so what, you know, that entails trying to intuit what the project sounds like, feels like in terms of the title. What would it sound like on, coming off your lips, your tongue, the title of this project, in terms of not only the aural sound of it, but the name of it and how it would feel, what kind of feelings would you connect with it?
Hmm.
So that's where I am with it.
Yeah.
You know, what best speaks of the totality of this project and what it means, not only to my family, which is my audience, my listeners, but to me,
mm-hmm.
and what kind of texture and contour and timbre and taste does it have? You know, what do we need to call it? It's almost like naming a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what do I want it to grow into?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, you know, with Khalil Gibran, you know, when, you know, the parents are like the bow and so
yeah.
In this instance, you know, you're the bow and the song and the,
yeah.
the project is the arrow, and you know, you want to make sure that you prepare it well to when it leaves you.
That's right.
So
once it leaves, ain't nothing you can do.
That's right. You can't call it back. That's true. Mm-hmm.
No, just prepare it well. Girl, you just hit the nail on the head. I used a whole bunch of words, and you just summed it up so beautifully.
I've been waiting a long time to talk to you. So, you know, I've been,
well,
you know.
Well, we're in the midst now. Yes, we're here now. Now is the time and the moment, and
mm-hmm.
we're enjoying it. I know I am.
Oh, this is so lovely, right. You know, when you were talking about, you know, needing, you know, some time to be still and to sort of
yes.
step out of the, I guess, almost like chaos, because
yes.
things are just spinning.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, definitely. And then also when you were, it sort of reminded me of how, you know, you started out running. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, you're singing in the second grade, you know, six years old. Mm-hmm. And then you've got a six and change octave range. And then you go to, you know, Berklee's College of Music, and you finish in 1 year. I'm like, how do you finish college in 1 year? That's like, wow, was that a record or what?
Well, the first thing is, don't believe everything you read.
Okay, I read it a few places, though.
Yeah, well, you know, nowadays, yeah, you've taken time to actually wait for the moment, the opportune moment to
mm-hmm.
be, you know, to connect with me, and in spite of everything that you, all the information that you have gleaned from all of your different sources,
mm-hmm.
you're actually getting, you know, now firsthand information from the horse's mouth.
Oh, totally. I'd love for you to correct
okay.
that. Mm-hmm.
Some
yeah.
people, no, I ain't trying to correct it, because you already are in the process. Some folks who happen to do what you do,
mm-hmm.
and notice my choice of words,
yes,
who happen to do what you do, for whatever reason, obviously, it ain't, you know, everybody ain't doing everything for the same reason.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily care about facts
mm.
or getting the facts straight. Just like some musicians don't necessarily care about singing in tune or playing in tune, you know what I mean? As long as they play.
Mm-hmm.
that information of finishing college in a year is incorrect.
Okay.
And people like to say stuff like that because that's how you get built up to be bigger than who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you show up, people look at you and just say, is that already? And I've had people tell me this, Wanda, you're shorter than I thought you were. You look bigger on TV. You'd be surprised what comes out of folks' mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So let's kind of put a pin in that balloon right now.
Okay.
I finished college in 1 year.
Okay.
I only went to college for 1 year, but I did do 2 years worth of work.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to come out because I couldn't afford to continue to pay for college.
Hmm. Wow. They didn't give you a full scholarship?
Oh, nay.
Oh, okay. Wow, because you were like a prodigy. I mean, you were really good. I mean, you play the violin and the piano, and you sing and you write. And you're a black woman, and there are not that many black women that do all that at 18?
Yeah. I think you're
you were like a treasure.
the same way that you were asking the question also answers the question
oh,
why.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Right.
You understand.
Oh, definitely.
Don't make me go there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and that was back in, what, 79, too?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had some really strong advocates in the way of my violin teacher, Margaretta Wolf, who taught me classical violin from third grade up through high school, and through Carmen Culp, who was my junior high school music teacher. Excuse me. And she happened to also be a vocalist herself.
Hmm.
And so she was tuned into voices and all things vocal.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she was testing the kids in seventh grade for their range to figure out if they were soprano, alto, tenor, or bass, you know, everybody had to sing, sing the scale as far as they could. And that's how she discovered, and me too, I had a range.
Hmm.
I wouldn't tell her no. I kept going when, you know, she said, just follow me at the piano and sing the scale.
Mm-hmm.
And all the kids were la, 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 la. We were, fidgeting and scratching and, half paying attention, all of us.
Mm-hmm.
But I happened to be one of the children who was able to continue way up to the end of the piano. And, everybody, the room got silent and her eyes got big. I thought I was in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know. I thought I'd done, because, at that age, life is basically black and white. You're either in trouble or you're out of trouble.
Hmm.
So I kept going, and I thought I was in trouble because her body language changed, and the look on her face changed. And then she told me afterwards that, she was really very nice, and very sweet and, very nurturing, because she had reassured me afterwards that I was not in trouble. She explained to me what was going on, that I had an extraordinary gift, and that it was a very large range, and that I need to, work with the gift.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember if they gave me an applause afterwards. I think so, but I don't really recall. But her name is Carmen Culp,
mm-hmm.
and she was the music teacher at Tredyffrin Easttown Junior High School out in west of Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
out on the main line
yeah.
in Pennsylvania. And she then began to show me breathing exercises to strengthen my breath control, my diaphragm. And she also immediately contacted her colleague, who happened to be the music teacher, head of the music program at the high school, and gave him a heads up that that I was here and I was on my way to high school. I'd mm-hmm. be there in a couple of years.
Nice.
I'd be there in 3 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when I got to high school, Paul Vanderslice took over.
Mm-hmm.
And he continued the work that Carmen Culp and Margaretta Wolf did. And it just so happened that all three of them were friends. The main line was really small back then.
Okay.
So I was, I had a very strong, agency
in
my music teachers and those adults who were around me who were tuned into music and who had a passion for music and could tell the difference,
mm-hmm.
Of someone who just liked music and someone who had a gift. They were able to spot the gift, because Lord knows I didn't know. I was singing with fire whistles. There was a fire engine in my neighborhood, and when the fire siren would go off,
mm-hmm.
I would run out on the front porch and try to copy it, because it went on so long. I was like, wow, I just like the way it, kind of amped up in frequency,
mm-hmm.
and it got louder. So it was a continual crescendo, not only in frequency, but in dB, volume as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so for whatever reason, as a child, that fascinated me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As I run out on a porch and try to sing the damn thing.
Wow. So you like the...
Someone told me that I wasn't supposed to be able to do that.
Yeah. Wow. So you like the science and the physics of it.
I am a nut about science and mm-hmm. physics and quantum physics.
Yeah,
quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
Girl, please. And most of my friends look at me and their eyes glaze over when I start talking about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
My best friends would tell me, get out of here, she's going to cut me. She says she won't stand me if she talks. I talk about that stuff, but I love it. Mm-hmm. I love it, and I love relating the abstract with the concrete, mm-hmm. because that's essentially what I do as an artist.
Yeah.
It's no different.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and
yeah.
And so when I see it in other areas, other fields, I gravitate to it. I'm like, wait a minute, I want to understand this. You know, so I can understand myself and what I do better.
Mm-hmm.
I was in with the birds and trying to make all kind, any kind of sound I heard, I try to make it. Because
mm-hmm.
also very important fact was, very important point was, there was no one around. I was very fortunate in this, that actually ever stepped out and said, you know, you ain't supposed to be singing like that. You're not supposed to, you know, human beings aren't supposed to sing like birds. You're not supposed to sing like a, you know, a fire whistle. That's not physically possible. They, you know, I guess for whatever reason, they ain't paying me no mind. You know, back then kids were largely ignored anyway unless you were doing something wrong, you know, or not doing your homework, or you can come in before the street lights are on. You know, that, you know, I grew up in a time before cell phones and pagers, and you know, there was like one or two phones in the house at most, and they were the old rotary dials.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then when the Princess Touch push button phone came, we couldn't even afford it, so we stayed with the rotary dials. And when, you know, you came home from school, you did your homework right away, depending on what the rules of the house were, or you went out to play after school. And part of my playtime is when children learn and develop and grow, and at every age, from birth right on up. And that's why I love to play and be stupid, because I recognize that there's a little girl, a little boy in each and every one of us.
Mm-hmm.
And when we stop playing, we stop learning and growing. And it's the, you know, we can learn, you know, through the didactic methods and, you know, through pressure and, you know, we do this or else I need to get a, you know, increase my pay or whatever. But the easiest, most facile way to gather new information and to process and understand and then use it, you know, to understand it enough to apply it is through play,
mm-hmm.
you know, or the energy of play or playfulness or youthfulness. It makes it light enough where I don't know, there's something about it that allows us to take it in. And it's not unlike music itself. You ever notice that kids can learn anything if it's in a song?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like that process.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's something that has fascinated me for years, and that's one thing that I refuse to give up is my playfulness.
Mm-hmm.
I tell my audience it's one of my favorite things to be is stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say stupid, I mean playful and silly and, you know, open to the possibilities and not so full of myself that, you know, I can't step outside of my perception of myself as an adult that everyone must take seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I was just thinking as you were talking, a few things came to mind. I just been taking notes. So,
okay.
Yeah, so I was just thinking back on your first, your debut CD, First Instrument, and
mm-hmm.
and what you said about translating the words into emotion. And then I was thinking about some of Octavia Butler, you know, the wonderful Ooh. Science fiction writer, and one of her characters, I don't know which book it is, but I really love that character, because what that character would do is, and there was a name for it, she could take the pain out of someone and into her body, and she would feel it. But she had greater capacity for the pain than they did. So when she took it into her body, you know, so if they had sores, she'd get the sores. And if they had
wow.
something wrong, she would get that too. But her body was equipped in such a way as that she could repair herself. I mean, she felt it all. It was like really excruciating and hurt. But the healing was possible, and it took a minute, but she would end up being okay again, and the person that she took the pain or the illness from, they will be well instantly. And I thought that
wow.
was, yeah, so what she'd have to do is sometimes she'd have to turn off that sensory perception of herself, because she'd always be in pain because everybody's hurting.
Right, all the time.
And I just thought, wow, that is so, Octavia Butler was so, like, she should be a saint or something, shouldn't she?
Wanda, listen, let me just tell you this. I have to, let me see, let me look at my time, because we're going to have to, I'm not calling you back. I'm going to but I mean, I'm going to have to call you back. We've got to stay in touch with one another because
that'd be super.
There's so much, you know, that I want to share and that I know that you want, I feel that you want to share. And there's so much that we have in common as a connection here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, short of, you know, we obviously have to get, I'm going to give you what you need. We have to get what you need for your interview.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, and I'm saying this now because I don't want to, you know, divert into the space that I feel myself pulling, you know, feel something inside me pulling to go.
Because
I'm like, in my spirit, I'm like pulling you by the hand. I'm like, come on, let's go out and play. You know what I mean?
Right, yes.
You know, let's get off this phone and run out in the grass and just sit and talk and play. But I know we got to take care of our business.
Right.
So I just wanted to put that on the table. Two things now, and one is that are just like huge and resonant in my spirit and in my heart. You mentioned Khalil Gibran, and I mentioned Khalil Gibran on Monday to a man that I met in first class on the flight back from Philadelphia. He didn't know who, I believe this was, I may be messing it up, but I, just within the last few days, I mentioned Khalil Gibran and the beauty of his poetry and his work and how, you know, oh, this is my best friend, Queen Gina. I shared with she and her husband that our children come through us.
Mm-hmm.
They do not belong to us. They are not our possessions. They come through us.
Right.
And so I don't really know too many people who even know about Khalil Gibran at this point.
Really?
You know, in the age of video games and Madden and, you know, reality TV shows and, you know what I mean, about that? Remember I was talking about the pace and the speed of life? I don't really know a whole lot of folk who take time to read books right now, let alone know about Khalil Gibran. So that's a huge salient, you know, orb that's resonating energy right there. And then the other thing is my girl.
Oh, yes.
I'm like a holler in your ear.
Oh, yes. I love Octavia Butler.
Oh, my goodness. Now, I'm wondering, if what you described, is that wild seed? And then we're going to get back to the interview.
Oh, it could be. It could be. I don't know, because I read them all except for her, the one about the vampire. I haven't read that one yet, the last one.
Okay.
But I read them all, and so I don't remember. Cause
it sounds like wild seed.
It could be wild seed.
The one about the woman that...
Yeah, going back in town, yeah.
Yes. You know, antebellum time era.
Yeah, and then she's got the trilogy where, you know, we destroy the planet and we got to connect with these other beings.
Power of the
Soul,
right?
That's before that. You know, she has those three books, and they're all about this these creatures, and they can't reproduce, and they need us to reproduce, and we need them to have somewhere to live.
Wow. I don't remember that series. I thought it was The Parable of the Sower.
No, that's after this. The Parable of the Sower is more, she wrote the others before The Parable of the Sower.
Okay.
Yeah, I love The Parable of the Sower and The Parable of the Talents. Oh, my God, that's like a Bible.
What's the second one, The Parable of the what?
The Talents.
Talents, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I missed a couple.
She's fantastic. But then also I was thinking, as you were talking about, when you were talking about some people don't even sing in tune, that there is a film. This is the Mill Valley Film Festival. It just started yesterday in Mill Valley and in San Rafael. And there's a film about Ali Akbar Khan.
Mm-hmm.
And he moved here from India and established a school. And his son, Alam Khan, is sort of continue the tradition and his teaching in the school. And, you know, his brother is too. And this film sort of looks at Ali Akbar Khan's family and the arc of his work and who he's collaborated with, people like John Handy and Mickey Hart, and how he brought in Zakir Hussain as his percussionist when he was really young. And the reason why I'm bringing him up is because he said, because they had footage of him talking about how important it is to sing in tune. That's more important than everything. Because singing in tune is like tuning your soul to the right frequency. And I wanted to tell you that.
Wow.
Yeah. And then another thing, and I know you know this has been a long talk conversation, but another thing is that I had another interview with a director who has been in love with Joseph Campbell, you know, the myth man, for a long time, and talking about the journey. Yeah, and the film is
Hero's Journey.
Yeah, and the film is called Finding Joe, and it's opening here in the Bay Area, I think at the end of this month, so I'm sure it's going to be in L.A. somewhere, because L.A. is where everything happens, and the filmmaker lives in Venice Beach, so he's down your way. And so when I was watching that film, and, you know, talking about the hero's journey and about how, you know, you look for these dragons and then you end up finding out that there is no external dragon. The dragon's inside, and you really need to not slay the dragon but embrace the dragon and see what it is that the dragon represents. And then you go back home to your community and you tell of your travels, and then you start all over again on another journey. So I just wanted to share those two things with you because they came to mind when I was listening
to
you.
Amazing. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Yeah. And then I had two questions, because I know you got to run. I wanted to ask you if you wanted to give me some more information about your project, like who your musicians are and how you all came together as a family. And then I wanted to ask you also if you could talk about, I just was reading, and you can correct me if this is wrong too, but about your relationship with Dizzy Gillespie, and that just sounded so fantastic.
Okay. One, let me just say that you know that this is you have touched a chord, a resonant chord in me, for me not to even think about my new CD, because it's amazing, and I've been just completely over the top about it. I don't even know what to say. It wasn't even on my radar until you just said it. So that lets me know that this is, you know, I'm just grateful.
Oh, me too.
It's been a long time since I've been stimulated into deeper parts of myself, as well as been able to connect with someone on this level. Mm-hmm. This is like wicked pissa cool, as a Bostonian used to say.
Mm-hmm.
I had an ex-boyfriend who was from Boston. Whenever something was like way beyond the beyond, he said, "Wicked pizza cool." So my CD, let me speak about Dizzy Gillespie, because I just finished speaking about that on a previous interview.
Oh.
I met Dizzy many, many years ago, and I was working for the New Jersey State Council on the Arts. Trying to eat, you know what I mean? Diz was already Diz, and had been Diz for a long time, and I was like a real, you know, a brand new artist, hadn't even placed on the map yet. And the New Jersey State Council on the Arts was just a way for me to continue my inroads, the quote unquote, paying dues, pounding the pavement, and to eat at the same time. It was a real good gig because it paid $100 a day.
Wow, yeah.
So back then, you know, in the 80s, that was big time.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time, you know, I had the great fortune of meeting, like, incredible jazz artists, because, you know, some folks like this were perennial and, you know, commanded, you know, the respect and attention from all over the world. But then there are others who kind of like faded, you know, not faded, but kind of fell back in the background of it, because, you know, Diz had a readily marketable brand, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And persona. So he had something that was about, not only is he, you know, a brilliant individual musician and, you know, the father of bebop, but in addition to all of that, he was like one of the pioneers in ways that many do not recognize and acknowledge, you know, not that I know of, not in the circles that I travel in.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, the bent-up horn, his personality, the stage persona and presence. You know, it was easy for folks to understand that and, you know, and he's created a brand with that, not just his music. And, you know, I met him, you know, through the New Jersey State Council on the Arts performing, and I just totally benign. I was totally oblivious. You know, I knew who Diz was, but, you know, I was just there for a gig, and he showed up just like I showed up, and it wasn't something I could get excited about beforehand because I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just trying to make the gig, and then I show up at the gig, and Dizzy Gillespie's there. And it was, you know, I wasn't, like, floored or anything, but it was an amazing thing in retrospect. You know, I think I was too young and too steeped in the music to, like, nowadays we live under such a cult of personality that it's hard to understand somebody being less than over the top if you be a star. And Dizzy, you know, at that time was a bona fide star. You didn't get too much bigger than that at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of hard to even describe, you know, what my experience was, you know, in any way that anybody could understand, because it's two different worlds. You know, nowadays, you can be a star for not knowing how to do nothing, not doing a damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
And will be like, you super mega gargantuan star, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Back then, in order to become a star, you had to, you know, put, first of all, you had to have a gift. And that gift entailed having something that no one else had and sharing it in a way that no one else could share it. You had to know. I remember this because I remember being told what the rules were back then. And that's what I developed. That's, you know, those of my generation, maybe it's the next one or so, came up under those rules, protocols, and regulations that as soon as you open your mouth, as soon as you play, or put your mouth to your instrument or your hand to your instrument, you have to have developed such a unique sound that everybody knows instantaneously who you are in the next, you know, in the next 2-3 seconds, who you are, which is a huge, you know, that was a huge, a tall order.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the norm for many, many, many years until the last, what, 20 years or so?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to describe what my experience with Diz was like in this current modern-day context, because very few, maybe old folks understand, remember,
mm-hmm.
what it was like back then, but most folks who, you know, who were considered themselves to be modern-day human beings, and then the, you know, the young folks, I don't want to use young folk, old folk like that, because I'm not a divisive kind of person,
mm-hmm.
but those who were born, say, after, you know, 70-something, they, you know, they grew up in a very different world.
Mm-hmm.
The world that they grew up in was a world that I kind of got caught in, you know. You know how you get caught between two? You know, I grew up and gathered all of these tools and stuff like you did with your waiting for this interview.
Mm-hmm.
Doing all the research, you're getting all the information.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Not only did the interview not come through, the requirements in order to get the interview changed.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, instead of being prepared, right, or overly prepared, you know, so when opportunity meets the, you know, whatever that saying is, the new rule now is you're not allowed to be prepared. You just got to wing it, freestyle. And if you're prepared, you will be penalized for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much what I went through in terms of, you know, the paradigm of not only the industry, but the world in general kind of shifted and changed. I kind of grew up and came of age in a time of transition or transit in terms of morals, values, the paradigm, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
like the Matrix, huh?
Exactly. Would you mind holding for 2 seconds?
Oh, no problem.
My dad calling. Hold on 1 second.
No problem.
I'll tell you who he is when I come back over, okay?
Okay, sure.
Thanks.
Yes, I am.
Okay, Wanda, I got a surprise for you.
Oh, my.
He can't stay long, but I just explained to him very quickly that you did so much research for so long, and, you know, just you're just now getting this interview, and you're so prepared for it. I just wanted to give you something special, and I can't give you anything any more special than this gentleman. This is my dad. He just happened to call in. His name is Bruce Lundvall, and he's the reason I am a recording artist today.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, it's so nice to meet you.
I think that's pretty extreme.
So that is just a bit of this wonderful conversation that I had with Rochelle Farrell in November of 2011, and I'm not going to play the portion of our conversation with her dad, Bruce Lundvall, because I didn't get his permission. So maybe at some other time. I didn't work on that last year, so it's just one of the many things that are on my to-do list to send him the clip and see if I could broadcast it. But in the meantime, I can't. So you're going to have to just come on out and see her band, because we're going to talk about that after Dad finishes talking to us and then signs off. And I'm not able to play the continuing part of the interview because it's not cut like that. So I'm going to play this wonderful piece, Rochelle Farrell, live in concert in Vienna on the 12th of July in 2001. And the piece that she is playing, she's on piano. It's really wonderful. I'll put the link to the clip on the website, wandaspix.com. Click on the blog, and if I have enough space, I'll also put it in the description of today's show. think there's a little pause. You know, sometimes.
Merci beaucoup. Mes familles.
That's for sure, for real. I think it was called Can't Explain. I moved to another section. Hopefully I'm remembering correctly the name of the song. Let me tell you. Let me check it just in case I'm not remembering correctly. We had a really wonderful show today. It was quite varied as usual and quite enlightening and inspiring as usual as well. And we're really happy that our guests were able to join us. Let me see, I'm still looking. Let's see, Rochelle. Yeah, I Can't Explain is the name of that song that we just heard. And so we had on the air today Dr. Evans as well as Mrs. Tiana Jones-Bay, and they were talking about the Praise Dance Festival, which is taking place in Sacramento tomorrow, July 7th, 7 o'clock. It's going to be at the Veterans Memorial Theater there, and it starts at 7. It's going to be really fantastic. It's their second annual. Sounds like it's going to be fabulous. And then we were joined by Mr. Jesse Brooks, who we were talking about the wonderful film, which is a part of the PBS Frontline series, and it's going to be kicking off on Tuesday nationwide. It's called Endgame, AIDS in Black America, and it's going to really be a phenomenal debut, this film. And definitely you want to catch it. The director, Renata Simone, is award-winning director, and this particular film is certainly among her best, if she can make anything else. So that's Tuesday, July 10th, Endgame, Ending AIDS in Black America. So that's going to be happening. That's going to be on television. You can catch that. Doesn't cost any money. You can catch Rochelle Farrell. She's at Yoshi's in San Francisco tonight, Friday, July 6th through Sunday, July 8th. And we are happy that we have winners of that pair of tickets that people are going to be able to catch her tonight at 10 o'clock. And I was thinking about ending the set with a couple of tunes. One I'm going to play, I really like Umi, and she's got a piece on Oya, which I just love. And so we're gonna play Feeling of My Way, Umoja, Feeling My Way, and then we're going to close out with Umi, Oya. And I don't know if we missed her or not. She was coming to town, and I'm not certain if that was June or July. But hopefully we haven't missed her because I just love that woman. She is fabulous. So here's Feeling My Way, and then we're going to go right into Umi, and we're going to be out until Wednesday, unless we have a special broadcast. We might have a special broadcast on Tuesday because Professor Bill Bell, the jazz professor, is having a birthday celebration concert at Yoshi's in Oakland, and so we're going to try to get him on the air on Tuesday. We're going to try to interview him on Monday, so if that works out, we might have a special broadcast, so stay tuned. Follow us, and so you don't miss any of our wonderful broadcasts. And I hear Stanford Jazz Festival is having a wonderful concert series this weekend, so you might want to check them out as well and see how you can fit everything in. Fillmore Jazz Festival, Stanford Jazz Festival, Rochelle Farrell, Roy Ayers. Oh, my goodness. Can't go wrong in the Bay.
every night the time is right for love, but you're not there beside me. So I'm just feeling my way. Jump out of bed, I take control. If I can just control this fire that burns in my soul, Lord, help me make it through a brand new day. The stars of night shining bright, my heart was pining for you. Through space and time, someday your love I'll find. Someday we're gonna meet, then my life will be complete. Until that lucky day, I'll pass the time away with you in my imagination, 'cause you're always on my mind. Up in the morning, oh, my job is getting hard to live without. Something tell me your good love I've got to find. Ladies up and down the street, looking so fine, so sweet. I look for your face everywhere. Where can you be? Ooh, baby, come home to me. I know you're out there somewhere. So let's begin this love again.
children can stop power.